Welcome to Season 7, Episode 4 of the StoryGrid Editor Roundtable Podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better writer using the StoryGrid method developed by Sean Coyne. Each week, we use a movie, a novel, or a short story to study different storytelling principles so that we can deepen our understanding of story and level up our craft. My name is Kim Kessler, and I'll be leading the discussion today. Here with me are my fellow roundtablers, Valerie Francis and Leslie Watts. I have a bittersweet announcement today. This will be my last season on the Roundtable podcast. I'm making a conscious effort to work in my flow state as much as possible, which means shifting to a more interactive format. If you're interested in live editing discussions in a mastermind-like atmosphere, join me for live editing workshop each month, absolutely free. Come with your latest writing pain point, and together we'll workshop you to your next right step. Just go to www.kimberkessler.com. That's KimberKessler.com. And you can sign up for my list and you'll receive a link to the next call session. I hope to see you there. Okay, so this week I'm looking at center stage in order to study core events. This 2000 film was directed by Nicholas Heitner from a screenplay by Carol Heikkinen. As always, this is an adult conversation. You may hear some adult words. Okay, let's go through the story. This is a mini plot story, and I struggled to put the axe into succinct five commandment statements, so I'm going to narrow the focus on Jody specifically. And then Valerie will go into more detail in her section. In the beginning hook, ballet dancer Jody wins her audition into the American Ballet Academy with hopes of making it into the company with her performance at the end of the year workshop. But when she is called into the director's office and told she doesn't have what it takes, Jody must decide whether to give up or keep going. She keeps going. In the middle build, Jody takes a break from ballet and visits a Broadway dance studio where she encounters the world-famous ballet dancer Cooper Nielsen. And they have a one-night stand. But when the roles for the spring workshop are announced, Jody is cast as the lead in Cooper Nielsen's experimental debut, and she must decide if she will dance through the awkwardness or give up. She keeps going. In the ending payoff, the day of the workshop arrives, but when Jody's dance partner is injured and Cooper decides he will dance in his place, Jody must decide whether to risk looking like an amateur or give up. She overcomes her nerves and dances her heart out, receiving a standing ovation. She opts not to join the American Ballet Company and instead becomes a principal in Cooper's new ballet company. Okay, so the genre for this is a global performance dance story, and it's paired strongly with a status sentimental internal story. So the principle that I'm studying, again, is core events. And so I'm going to go through the core event of the performance and the status genre. So the core event is the big moment of change that pays off each genre. It's the ultimate payoff of reader expectations that have been set up and built up over the course of the story, and it's where the reader experiences the height of that all-important core emotion, which is that experience that they're most hoping for when they read the genre. In a more technical way, the core event is the moment when the global life values are most at stake, meaning the protagonist has the most to gain or the most to lose. The main reason I picked center stage this week is because of the clear core event moments for both the performance and the status genre. And because it's a mini plot, we get to experience these moments from multiple characters. And sometimes these genres can be tricky to tell apart. They both stem from the esteem tank, and so they have that same core need at stake, but they express it through different core values, and they evoke different core emotions in the audience. So let's look a little closer to see the distinctions between the performance genre and the status genre. In the performance genre, the fundamental question is, will the protagonist do what is necessary to pursue and fully express their unique gifts, despite the difficulties? Performance stories are about the outward expression of our internal gifts and our need for approval. Each person has an extraordinary internal gift, but not everyone is willing to do what it takes to express it unconditionally. This takes great effort. Some may only express it if they know it will be well received and respected. Others refuse to express it for fear of rejection, even if it would be well received. Seeing others exert this effort in the face of challenges and overcome them to ultimately express their inner gift, it fills us with this sense of triumph. So, why is the big performance scene the core event for a performance story? This is the moment when the protagonist must display their gift for all to see, risking failure and shame. The stakes of respect and shame are at their highest because of who is watching. The audience of the performance is. And what their respect means to the protagonist. Will the protagonist be able to handle the pressure? Will they choose to express their gift in the face of risk? Will they persist in the face of adversity? Their actions in this big fight, big game, big recital show us the answer. In the end, it's not how well they do, but the fact that they are willing to take the risk. When they do take the risk, give it their all, and perform at their highest potential, the emotion that evokes in us is hard to beat. The universal takeaway, or as I like to call it, the big meta why, of a performance story is we gain respect when we commit to expressing our gifts unconditionally, but shame results when we hold our gifts back for fear of criticism or reprisal. Performance stories show us that the unconditional expression of our unique gift, that is, its full expression and display, freed from personal shame and not dependent on respect from others, this is the key to respect and personal fulfillment. We must be willing to show our true selves and what we are truly capable of, no matter what. Okay, let's look closely at the status genre. In the status genre, the fundamental question is, will the protagonist be able to rise in social standing and achieve their personal definition of success? Status stories are the internal expression of our external definitions of success, which is highly subjective to the individual. The dilemma of the status protagonist comes down to being at odds with their moral code. Each subgenre of status creates a specific prescriptive or cautionary tale that demonstrates an opportunity to rise or a challenge to overcome. The question then becomes, what are we willing to do in order to rise or overcome? How far are we willing to go? And are we willing to do whatever it takes? Will they stay aligned with their moral code and gain success? This positive prescriptive outcome occurs when the protagonist has a present and adequate mentor to guide them. The mentor enables them to find a reasonable definition of success, one that they can achieve without abandoning their moral code, and a strong enough will to pursue it. We see this in the subgenres of sentimental and admiration. Or will they abandon their moral code and fail? This negative cautionary outcome occurs when the protagonist's mentor is absent or present but flawed. This leads to an unreasonable definition of success, one they cannot achieve without abandoning their moral code. This causes them to give up and not try, try and fail, or succeed but at the cost of their moral code. We see this in the subgenres of pathetic and tragic. So, why is the choice of the protagonist to do what's necessary to attain higher status or reject the world they strive to join, why is this moment the core event for a status story? The protagonist must decide what they are willing to do to gain their definition of success. Depending on the specifics of the story and the subgenre, this could mean exerting their will, changing their definition of success, or abandoning their moral code, also known as selling out. This defining action takes place in the core event scene. Because status stories are an internal genre, the nature of this core event will be flavored by the external genre it's paired with. A status story paired with performance will be different than a status story paired with crime. The universal takeaway of a status story is success results when a person is true to their values, whether or not it leads to social betterment. But failure results when a person sells out their values for unworthy goals. Status stories show us that we are the sum of our choices, but also that our choices are greatly dictated by the external circumstances that we face, opportunities, challenges, and the presence or absence of an adequate mentor. It is impossible to be successful on our own. We are fundamentally dependent on others. These stories are a call to find a strong mentor and heed their advice, as well as a call to be a strong mentor to others. Show up and share your expertise. It could mean the difference between a sentimental or tragic ending. So you can see that these genres, performance and status, pair so well together because status is baked into performance. This isn't to say, obviously, that you can't pair with another genre, but there's likely always going to be some status nuance in a performance story. Okay, so let's look at a few core event moments in center stage that demonstrate these genre principles. So I'm going to talk about the three main dancers here. Eva, her performance core event culminates as Eva declares her unconditional devotion to her gift. So Eva makes the decision to dance for herself, regardless of what happens, and to keep dancing long after the workshop. This leads Maureen to ask Eva to dance in her place, and Eva dances magnificently. Now, Eva's status core event is Eva sticks close to her moral code and gains the success she wanted. So Eva is scolded for dancing in Maureen's place without telling anyone. She apologizes, but then takes it back because the dance was the best time of her life. She is offered a place in the company and accepts. Now, Maureen, her performance and status core event feel like they are the same moment to me. Maureen follows her moral code and denounces ballet as her true gift, and she leaves behind the world that she sought to join. Maureen asks Eva to dance in her place, and Maureen tells her mother that she doesn't want to be a ballerina because it makes her unhappy and sick. She wants to find something that she loves, not just something she happens to do well. And for Jody, Jody's performance core event is Jody struggles to unconditionally give her gift but overcomes. So Jody's nervous the night before the performance, and Cooper pressures her about hitting the fuetes at the end because he wants everything to be perfect. Charlie tells her to just dance it how she feels it. When the time comes, she dances with all her attitude and nails it, receiving a standing ovation from the crowd. Jody's status core event is Jody discovers and chooses a better definition of success that truly honors her gift. Cooper tells her that the ballet was a success and his benefactor is going to fund his company. He asks Jody to be in his company as its star, and he says they'll be great together. Then it's Jody's turn to meet with Jonathan and learn if she has earned a spot in ABC. But she asks Jonathan not to say anything because she knows that either way, the best dancer that she can be is as a principal in Cooper's new company. So when you look at each of these moments, it's clear to see how and why they pay off everything that came before for each character. For Eva, she had fear of success in the beginning hook, and she struggled with authority in the middle build. For Maureen, she had guaranteed success in the beginning hook, but then she struggled with her mental and physical health in the middle build. And Jody struggled with technique in the beginning hook, and then she was recognized for her unique style in the middle build. So when you recognize the purpose and power of the core event moment, you can double down on intention in every other moment of your story and execute your craft at the highest level. Okay, so that is a little bit about the core events. Valerie is going to take us through the 3-act structure in multiple protagonist stories. Take it away, Valerie.
Thank you, Kim. this is a shocker. I disagree with Kim just a little bit in that I don't think this is a true mini plot story. I see it more as an arch plot with multiple protagonists, but to have a full discussion on that requires a whole nother episode, and it's really neither here nor there for today's discussion. So this week, I'm going to continue my study of the 3-act story structure. And as I've mentioned before, Sean has recently expanded his concepts of how the beginning, middle, and end of a story work. And I've got a beat about this coming out later this year. So the best way, in my opinion, to understand a story principle is this. First, you study the story principle in theory. Then you apply that theory to as many different stories as possible. And then you use the principle in your own work. Now, reading the various Story Grid books and articles and listening to all 3 of our podcasts, these are the ways that we understand the principles in theory. What I'm trying to do here on the show is demonstrate to you how I apply the principles to a story so that you have a model to follow. You'll still need to do your own study, of course, but hopefully this will give you a jumping off point. All right. So with that said, the main protagonist in center stage is Jody. So that's who I'll be focusing on. We get a lot of questions here at StoryGrid about stories with multiple protagonists, and love stories that are written from both lovers' points of view is a common example. A lot of people ask about that. There's certainly no problem in having more than one protagonist, even in an arch plot story. If this is the approach you're taking in your novel, the trick to it is to create a hierarchy among the characters. The storyline for one of your characters will take priority. If you remember the Hidden Figures episode we did, and I'll link to that in the show notes, you'll recall that Catherine is the main protagonist. Dorothy was second in the hierarchy, and Mary is third. In center stage, as I said, Jody is the main protagonist, so her story will create the main through line for the film. Eva's story and Maureen's story are secondary plot lines. Generally speaking, the beginning hook is all about establishing the protagonist in her ordinary world. The middle build is when the hero crosses into the extraordinary world, and the ending payoff is when the protagonist creates this new normal for herself. And we're all learning about a new normal right now. So hopefully the ending payoff will start to make more sense to us. So how does this shake out in center stage? Well, interestingly, Jody crosses into her extraordinary world immediately. By the end of the opening credits, she's at the ballet school. So for the past 2 weeks, I've been discussing the breakdown of the middle build one and middle build two. And a lot of the things that I said about middle build one could actually be applied to the beginning hook of this story. It kind of is like the calm before the storm in Jody's life. So at first blush, this simple story can seem a bit complicated, but not to worry. This is one place where switching our focus from the micro view to the macro view can really help us make sense of what's going on here. Honestly, I think having Jody enter the extraordinary world of the Ballet Academy immediately was a really smart storytelling choice because, well, first of all, there are multiple storylines to follow, but also because Jody's particular storyline isn't all that deep, so we don't really need to know what her life was like before she hits the academy. And it's a dance performance story, so the filmmakers need to create as much time as possible in a two-hour film for the dancing, because that's part of what we're paying our money for, right? And there is a whole lot of amazing dancing. If you're a fan of ballet or dance, the show is worth watching just for that. So one note about multiple protagonist stories. Often the storylines are diluted. Not always, but often. And that's simply because there are so many stories to tell that there really isn't time to dive deeply into any of them. In center stage, Maureen's story is third in the hierarchy, so there isn't time to fully explore it, but it is fertile ground for storytelling. Black Swan is Maureen's story fully examined, and look what the screenwriters and filmmakers of Black Swan managed to do with it. Incredible. Films generally have a two-hour limit. Novels are generally in that 80 to 100,000 word count zone. And even though word counts aren't as big a deal in today's publishing industry as they once were, I mean, because a lot of books today are digital and because we have print on demand, from a craft perspective, the longer the book is, the harder it is to maintain a reader's interest and attention, and the greater the danger that the middle build will sag. Multiple storylines, especially in a novel, add an extra layer of storytelling difficulty. In a film, viewers spend just a couple of minutes on each storyline. So, for example, if we don't like Eva's story, we only have to sit through a couple of minutes before Jody's story kicks back in. In novels, depending on a person's reading speed and the time they have to spend reading a book, it can be weeks before they get back to the story that they're most interested in. So as writers then, we run the risk of having our readers put our books down and not pick them back up again. Choosing to use a single protagonist over multiple protagonists isn't better or worse, they're two totally different approaches. And like all other storytelling principles, there are advantages and disadvantages to each option. So as writers, what we want to do is decide on the kind of story we want to tell and then figure out which of the tools in our writer's toolbox will help tell it, help us tell it the best. In terms of story structure, the beginning hook of Center Stage is establishing Jodi's ordinary world within the dance school. Now, it also establishes Eva's and Maureen's ordinary worlds within the dance studio as well. When we realize that, all the pieces start to fall into place. In her ordinary world, Jodi is a substandard dancer in a highly disciplined and regimented academy. In the middle build, Jodi rediscovers her love of dance. The extraordinary world, then, is a dance without hard and fast rules. It's life outside the confines of the academy. Middle build one is the calm before the storm. The protagonist is trying to navigate this strange new world the best she can, using the knowledge, skills, tools, beliefs, and perspectives that she brought with her from her ordinary world. Jodi takes a class at the Broadway Dance Center. And again, if you're into dance at all, you know exactly what the Broadway Dance Center is. And she has a blast, and it is really cool there. Very cool there. She encounters the shape-shifting antagonist of her storyline, who, as Kim said, is Cooper. And he catches a glimpse of her gift for dance. Now, note that Jonathan is a global antagonist, but each of the storylines has its own secondary antagonist. Cooper is the antagonist for Jodi's story. Eva is her own worst enemy. So the antagonist there is primarily internal. And with Maureen, her mother is the antagonist. The turning point of Middle Build 1 is when the protagonist tries to outmaneuver the antagonist. And in Center Stage, this plays out in a love story. Jodi, bless her heart, does not understand that the tryst with Cooper is a one-off. And so she attempts to continue the relationship with him. He quickly makes it clear, and he is so cold, it's heartbreaking, but he really makes it clear that it was a one-night stand, which means then for Jodi that her crisis is whether she'll continue to dance in his number or quit. She decides to channel her anger into her craft and returns to rehearsal. And of course, she blows everybody away with the emotion and the energy she brings to her performance. The midpoint shift, which is also called the midpoint climax or the point of no return, marks the hero's fall into chaos. The second part of the middle build is when the protagonist descends into chaos. And when the protagonist is in chaos, the whole story and everybody in it is also in chaos. Because there are multiple protagonists, the chaos phase, I have to admit, is pretty shallow for all three of the characters. In terms of Jodi's story, the chaos phase begins when Eric sprains his ankle and Cooper has to dance his part with Jodi and Charlie. It passes by fairly quickly, though, because to be honest, the filmmakers just had to dramatize the chaos in Maureen's life and the chaos in Eva's life. And then they have to get on with the big performance, right? Which, as Kim just said, is the core event that we have been waiting an hour and a half for. Much of the ending payoff plays out in the performance. The dance Cooper choreographs is a reenactment, essentially, of the relationship he had with Jodi. So it's in the dance that she finally stands up to him and sort of chooses Charlie, but ultimately learns to stand on her own two feet as a dancer. While it makes for a stunning performance, from a storytelling point of view, it's a bit odd. Remember, Cooper choreographed it. So Jodi is not actually making any of the decisions on her own. She's dancing the dance that he's taught her. However, she is bringing an attitude to her performance. And the attitude is this new belief in herself, and that drives her performance home, and that's part, a huge part, I think, of what gives her the standing ovation. After the performance, there's a bit of gratuitous dialogue where Jodi tells Cooper that while he's a terrific dancer and choreographer, he's a lousy boyfriend. But we all knew that. She already showed that to us in the dance. But anyway, there it is. So with multiple protagonist stories, The key is to create a hierarchy with one protagonist taking priority over the others. Find ways to maintain your reader's interest as you switch from one storyline to another. And remember that if your story runs long, you'll have to pay very close attention to the narrative drive in your story so that the middle bill doesn't sag. Of course, you'll also need to make sure that the storyline for each protagonist is fully developed. And you may have to trade depth for breadth. That is, the internal development of your character might have to suffer because you've given yourself a really large canvas that you have to cover in a relatively short period of time. So that's what I have to say about center stage.
Awesome, Valerie. Thank you so much. That was great. So Leslie, you are looking at point of view and narrative device, and walk us through what you think about center stage.
Okay, yes, I'm continuing my study of point of view and narrative device this season. I know you're all very shocked to hear that. So if genre is what your story is about, the point of view and narrative device are how you deliver it to the reader or viewer, as in our story today. And that's why I firmly believe that your point of view and narrative device choice is the most important decision you make after the global genre. The narrative device or situation is the content or the substantive element of the way you deliver the story to your reader. And it answers the questions, who or what is the source of the story? When or where is that source located in relation to the events? Who is the story for and why is it being told? Point of view, on the other hand, is the technical element, which tells us whether it's first person or third person, for example, and it answers the question, how do we create the effect of the narrative device? Now, point of view and narrative device give writers useful constraints for making content and technical decisions from macro to micro in their stories, not at random or on a whim, but for solid story-based reasons. I'm on a quest to understand how point of view and narrative device work and how to choose the best one for your story. I explore this in my upcoming Story Grid beat on point of view, as well as in my bite-sized episode on choosing your point of view. And I'll include links to those in the show notes. I start my analysis by asking about the opportunity presented by the premise. The premise is a specific character or characters in a setting with a problem. A center stage is about Jodi and her fellow students and friends in the American Ballet Academy who want to succeed as dancers. We have, as Kim said, a performance story. And the question is, will the protagonist do what's necessary to unconditionally express their individual gifts? Now, a lot of what dancers or drummers, or baseball players, or painters do is practice. Practice, training, and study are the day-to-day actions that allow an artist or athlete or scientist to express their unique gifts. Now, while this is an important element of performance stories, it's repetitive and not that interesting for readers. We need to include some of this because training is a convention of the genre. But the story is really about the external and internal obstacles that get in the way. So we need to see the protagonist interact with multiple areas of their lives. Similarly, the status story requires a representation of different levels of social standing within a particular environment and a wide range of perspectives. So the point of view and narrative device of a story like this need to allow for multiple settings and perspectives to execute the story well and fulfill its promise, especially since we have one central protagonist with several other secondary and tertiary characters. So what's the point of view of center stage? I've mentioned before that point of view can be tricky to identify in films, but what I do is look at what the scenes reflect. The scenes get close to the characters in center stage, but it still feels to me like we're on the outside looking in. We spend very little time with the characters when they are alone. Almost always, at least one of their character observes the primary character in the scene. So the events seem to be the result of multiple events seen and heard around the academy. So even the scene when Jody is alone with Cooper, it's something that people could assume based on the circumstances that they see or hear later. So I would identify the point of view as what Norman Friedman calls dramatic mode, or what others have called autonomous narration. There's no character point of view. It feels like watching a stage play in which mental states are implied solely by action. If you're looking for an example of this in writing, Hills Like White Elephants by Ernest Hemingway or The Lottery by Shirley Jackson are good examples of this. So that's the point of view. What is the narrative device? Well, again, we don't have an explicit or overt narrative device, so I'm working based on my impression of the scenes and the most likely point of view. It feels to me like a young dance teacher who has combined several events after the fact involving different dancers all into one story for other young dancers to help them avoid the pitfalls that come up while pursuing success in dance. It feels as if the narrator has some perspective, that is, they're a little bit removed from the actual experience of being a student in dance, or at least that they have more perspective than the characters within the story. In a way, it feels to me like a stage play, or perhaps more appropriately, a dance, much like the one that Cooper choreographed for the workshop. So that motive or purpose in telling the story seems consistent with what I identify as the controlling idea, that dancers gain respect when they express their gifts unconditionally according to their personal definition of success, which of course includes their moral code. So that's my assessment of the point of view and narrative device of center stage. How well does that work? In other words, how well do those choices solve the problems presented by premise, or more appropriately, perhaps, the opportunities afforded by the premise? I think the point of view and narrative device here do a fine job of presenting the story. It doesn't feel really innovative, but it does deliver the story in an adequate way. In a way, it reminds me of manuscripts I've seen when the writer has chosen a global narrative device, but it's not quite specific enough to allow them to enact that device through the scenes. Now, I've read that some people really, really love this story, and I don't want to take anything away from that, but I suspect a lot of it has to do with the spectacle of dance and music. And as Valerie said, the dance scenes are amazing. But I found myself wishing that the ending payoff had more story and a little less dance. Now, writers of novels don't have the benefit of hiring dancers and musicians to fill in the gaps in a story. So if you want to tell a story like this, you need to consider how you're going to replace the visual and auditory spectacle. Now, my best advice for this is to let masterworks be your guide. And I don't have a great example to recommend yet, but I am definitely on the lookout for one.
Awesome. Thank you, Leslie. That was fantastic, as always. We like to round out our discussion with a few key takeaways for writers who want to level up their own writing craft. So what have we learned this week? Let's hear first from Valerie.
If you're writing a multiple protagonist story, you need to keep a few things in mind. Create a hierarchy of characters. Find ways to maintain your reader's interest across the storylines. And if your story runs long, pay really close attention to the middle build, so it doesn't sag, and to the narrative drive so that your readers will keep turning pages. And also keep an eye on the internal and external genres and decide how deeply you want to examine each of these, certainly each of the internal genres, for each of your protagonists.
For me, Center Stage really highlights the differences between film and written stories. So studying films is valuable. The Roundtable was founded on this idea. But when you want to write a novel, you also need written masterworks to show you how to translate the film that unfolds in your mind to the page and ultimately to the mind of your reader.
Understanding the root of your genre and why it exists, that big meta why for humanity, will help you better understand what and why the core event moment is and how to identify it in your story and maximize its impact on your specific audience. To wind up the episode, we take questions from our listeners. This week's question comes to us from Mark Pyle, who asked us this question on the Story Grid Guild. Mark writes, "What are some tricks to track multiple POVs in an epic story, like Game of Thrones, etc.? And what are common problems to watch out for in such a story structure?"
Well, this is an excellent question, Mark. Epic fantasy stories like A Game of Thrones or The Way of Kings, or even a literary story with multiple POV characters like The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, have extra moving parts that you'll need to take into account when planning, drafting, and revising your story. The good news is that we use the same tools that we would use in a less complex story. So I want to start with the biggest problems to watch out for and then talk about how we use StoryGrid tools to solve them. When you have multiple subplots that are external and internal, you add layers of complexity that all need to work together as a unified story. It is really easy to get lost in the writing and end up with a series of interesting events that don't amount to a story. It's harder to figure out what you have and what to include or leave out when you have a story with such a wide scope, too. And there is the temptation, even more than in a typical story, I think, to add events or characters, whether they're relevant or not, because it's cool. After all, what could an extra 1,000 or 3,000 words hurt in a story that's so long anyway? Hey, no judgment, we've all been there. Epic fantasy readers are patient, but I wouldn't want to push them too far. So the best tools to help you solve these problems are the ones that help you move between the two major units of story, that is the macro or global story and the micro or the scenes. The first thing we need to get a handle on is the global story. Subplots abound, but what is your story really about? And what's the global genre? The tools we use for this are the Editor's Six Core Questions and the Global Foolscap Story Grid. In working with Valerie on her psychological thriller with multiple storylines, we turned the foolscap into a ledger with a column for the global or macro story, as well as the major subplots. Now, this allows us to look at the entire story on one large sheet of paper. Then we need to look at the micro building blocks of the story, the scenes. We use the Story Grid spreadsheet to evaluate and identify potential problems at this level of the story. Now, of course, one of the columns in the standard spreadsheet is for tracking point of view. That allows you to see generally how often and when point of view characters are showing up. Now, one thing I want you to keep in mind is that the spreadsheet is like a tool belt, and you add the tools or columns that you need for the level of analysis that you're currently doing. So if you need a column specific to your subplots or some other element, go for it. Make these tools work for you. Now, in the Guild Q&A session, Sean talked about how he and Scott McClelland used different colors of index cards assigned for different characters with story events, when they were working on the sand sea. This allowed them to move the pieces around and see how they work together. It's just another way to provide a different perspective and different level of analysis. Now, as a practical matter, you might use index cards or a spreadsheet program or Scrivener or Notion. And StoryGrid editor Randy Searles has a great post with some information about using Scrivener to track scenes like this. The big takeaway is that just as in any story, you need a way to move back and forth between the macro and micro to evaluate whether everything is aligned and you're telling one story with multiple threads.
Fantastic. Thank you, Leslie. If you have a question about point of view, core events, or any other story principle, you can ask it on Twitter at StoryGridRT, or better still, by going to storygrid.com/resources, clicking on Editor Roundtable Podcast, and leaving us a voice message. So that wraps it up for this week. Great discussion. Thank you so much, Leslie and Valerie, for your excellent editorial insights into Center Stage. We hope our discussion has given you a better grasp of how to execute the core event of your own stories. You can find links and additional materials in the show notes at storygrid.com. And if you want to connect with one of us directly, links to our websites can be found in the show notes. To support the show, leave us a rating and review and tell your writer friends about us. And then join us next time when Valerie will look at the middle build in the 2019 film Marriage Story, available on Netflix. Why not give it a look during the week and follow along with us? Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.